Please welcome Darlene Cohen speaking to the Sacramento Buddhist Meditation Group on January 17, 2004 on Dana Paramita.
Good morning. Now, can everyone hear all right at this tone of voice? Okay. So, we are having a pretty hard time in the world right now. I mean, I guess we always have. It's just that at least the people I know and see all the time are very aware of the extreme suffering in the world. And whenever we read the news or hear the news, we suffer a fresh assault on our peace of mind, because all over the world, the innocent and the not so innocent are suffering, and some of them in our name. But we don't have to go anywhere in the world. We don't have to go across the ocean to find hotbeds of suffering. We only have to look around us and to feel our own suffering. And down the street, probably, all over our country, children are being beaten and abandoned. Their parents are caught in a cycle of despair and hopelessness. An ex-police officer told me that the reason she turned to Zen, that she started a Zen practice, is that whenever she was on a call, to a violence call, neighbors would call in because there was some violence next door, and she would go into the home where this was happening, this violent scene was going on, and she would see toddlers, children 2 and 3, and they weren't crying. You know, they weren't frightened. Their eyes were dead. And she said that's what made her take up a practice. She couldn't stand the children with dead eyes. So in the neighborhood where Zen Center is in San Francisco, until it was recently yuppified, there were lots of teenage whores and crack dealers that we saw all the time and conversed with, and hung around the building during Sashin. So if you stepped outside to get a breath of fresh air, there they were. So not only do we have to read about it and go someplace to find it, but just stepping outside of our own doors sometimes, we can become acquainted with the extreme forms of suffering. I certainly hope that everyone in this room has subtle forms of suffering. More subtle than these gross forms I've just been describing, but we certainly are aware of this if we live in a city of any size. And most of us, when we think of all this suffering, most of us go numb ourselves. We're like the adult version of the children with dead eyes. We can't stand it, so we blot it out. And this overwhelmed, helpless feeling that we have when we watch the news, this is the near enemy of compassion. The far enemy is indifference, when you just don't care about this particular strife in Africa or the Middle East or wherever. That's indifference. That's the far enemy. That's as far away from compassion as you can get. But the near enemy is just being overwhelmed. I can't stand it. I can't live my life knowing about this. That's the near enemy, closer to compassion, but not no cigar. So when we're so undone by the suffering of others that we have to blot it out to go on with our own lives, the result is the same as if we were indifferent. The world's a little meaner, a little bleaker, a little more alienated. So it's important that we resist this energy-draining helplessness we feel in the face of other people's great suffering. And the depression that we feel in a culture that's emphasizing ruthless materialism and acquisition right now. So we must rally ourselves to present a clear and unambiguous alternative to unchecked greed and materialism. We as individuals can present an alternative to this in the midst of a culture that values something else altogether. So I think that each of us has to make a clear and unwavering commitment to ourselves to creating compassion and kindness in a world gone mad. So this is just on the simple level of letting someone into your lane when you're driving. It took me years to figure that out. But finally I did. You know, as I'm zooming by someone, I'm thinking, wait a minute. This is not kind. This is just business as usual. So you can be caught up, so caught up in the culture, in the cultural norm, that you can't even find it in your own behavior. So we must make some clear and unambiguous commitment to kindness and compassion. Now, some people isolate themselves to blot out the suffering of other people. They have enough suffering of their own. They move to the country, or they stop getting the newspaper, stop reading the news. I know people like this. Or they get very preoccupied with their own self-expression, preoccupied with it to the point that, you know, it's just what they're doing and not what anybody they don't personally know is doing. But I think we have to ask ourselves, as Buddhists, as practitioners, and even if you aren't a Buddhist, as a practitioner of sitting practice, of sitting to just be with what is, I think we have to ask ourselves, what is life about? What increases or decreases our connection, our involvement, our satisfaction in life? What makes us feel happy? And cutting ourselves off, I think, has its upside, of course. You aren't brought down by the latest horrendous thing that's happened, but you also start to pay for that over time. You start to feel isolated and disconnected. One thing I loved about living in the neighborhood of the San Francisco Zen Center is it was ground zero for suffering. There was no way that I could ever feel disconnected from immediate suffering, and know every minute, no matter what kind of suffering I personally was doing, it was subtle and soluble as opposed to the despair I saw just by leaving my house. So I know that it really goes against the grain in our self-absorbed culture right now to be involved with the suffering of strangers. But that involvement does answer some primal feeling that we have, some primal intuition that we have about the nature of reality, which is that we are all connected. Connected with the people, that we don't even have to hear of them. We're connected with them and other beings as well, even invisible beings. So there's plenty of evidence that Americans are willing to be small-minded, opinionated, violent, and ruthless, but there are also examples of the opposite. And I think we can take heart. For instance, the enduring popularity of Oprah Winfrey's daytime TV show, and her competition is, you know, people who are just exploitive, you know, of other people, making us aware of how smart we are compared to how dumb the people on their shows are. Oprah Winfrey does the opposite of this. She celebrates community heroes, you know, postmen who give so much money out of their paycheck every month so that someone in their neighborhood can go to college. You know, she celebrates people like that. And I think that this is so great that somebody on national TV does this kind of thing. And when she was questioning, not even saying don't eat meat, but questioning the meat industry, whether people should eat this, and they sued her, the Cattlemen's Association sued her, she just took her show right down. Ask people on the street, you know, how do you feel about this? How do you feel about this? Totally joining, you know, totally curious. And this kind of example for us is very important because it goes against the grain in our culture right now. Each of us should be willing to go against the grain. So I think of Oprah Winfrey as right up there with Santa Claus, you know, toiling day in and day out, making toys for people he doesn't even know, you know, and then one day a year delivering them without pay. Without pay. This is a wonderful example of bodhisattva, of a person who does not take the step over the threshold of liberation, so that he or she can hang back with the rest of us to give us a little, hold our hands while we go to hell. So this is a great example for us. And the reason I mention all this today is because I've been particularly fascinated for the past year or so, kind of focused on Dana Paramita. Now, in the context of how to maintain our interest and joy and energy and compassion in the face of no reinforcement from our culture, or just opposite message, it's very important to have a group like this and a group like your Sanghas, the Iron Bell and SBMG. It's very important to have people like this that support you in your practice, in the face of despair and ruthlessness. So I would like to talk this morning about Dana Paramita. It's one of the six paramitas that bodhisattvas practice, and paramita literally means crossing over to the other shore. Paramita is the perfection of whatever it is, crossing over to the other shore. So to get from anguish and depression to compassion and joy, we have to do something. We have to do something, and that something is practicing the six paramitas. So first is Dana Paramita that I'm going to talk about this morning, and this is giving. It's, as I said earlier, it's not like in the charity sense of giving, where you can get a break on your income tax if you write a check to someplace. Now, that's great. There's nothing wrong with that. That's great, but Dana Paramita more refers to kind of a generosity, the generosity that arises from a feeling of bounty yourself. Not just that you go around giving people things, but that you feel bounteous. It's your responsibility to feel bounteous. Especially in this culture, nobody is going to give you stuff. You have to take responsibility for your own feeling of bounty and generosity, and this is what Dana Paramita is. So, the six paramitas are first Dana, which I'll talk about, and secondly is an ethical life, following the precepts. Third is patience, and this is usually has to do with anger. You know, when you have feelings of resentment or righteousness or anger, being patient. And that's a whole other story, which I won't get into. Perseverance, diligence, raising your energy. It takes a lot of energy to practice, especially if you're going up the river, which is the case in our culture right now. You're going up the river. So that takes a lot of energy. And how do you raise that energy? You have to have some way to keep your energy up. And the paramitas are what do that. And then meditation, sitting, and then wisdom, which is quickly. Wisdom is probably the closest way to explain that is right view. I'm just plucking out one of the aspects of wisdom, but right view is being able to see things as just rising and passing away. Rising and passing away. May stay around a little longer than you had in mind, but can see it rise and pass away. Or if it's something you like, it doesn't stay around long enough. So it rises, oh goody, oh, but it passes away. We will all lose loved ones. We will all have disappointments. Come and things go. So it's wisdom in a nutshell. Thank you for indulging me on that one. So the practice of Dana Paramita is basically stepping into the flow. How do you produce this feeling of bounty? It's by stepping into the flow of life. It's breath-based and sense-based. It's looking at your life from the point of view of breath and sense, the very thing that we're doing today. We don't have any decisions to make today. We've already made them. If we forget something vital, it's all over, so we don't have to think about it anymore. So we can just be here with our senses and our body. And so Dana Paramita, or creating the conditions for feeling of bounty, is kind of noticing the perceptual flow in which you don't break your experience up into good and bad, or giving and taking, or any of the other possibilities. It's just your experience. You don't break it up. Or when you do break it up, like, I'm here in this room, but I need to go to the bathroom. So I will actually leave this room and have a new experience. So when you do break it up, you know that you're doing that. You're aware that you had this thought and you're going to act and carry it out. You have an intention. So when you do break it up into particular ideas like that, or a flash of anger comes, the person is walking too close to you, and you have a flash of anger. They shouldn't do that. They're walking wrong. And just to know you're breaking things up into right and wrong. So you know what you're doing, that you're manipulating things and ideas and judgments. You're imposing them on things that don't inherently have this. They don't inherently have what you're imposing. And you recognize that. For instance, I'm sitting on a thing called a chair. It's a chair because I'm sitting on it. That is the reason it's a chair. It's being used as support for my body. But it's metal. It has different parts. It folds up. If you saw it folded up and it was real dim in here, you might not even know it was a chair. And a dog who walked in here would see not a chair, but a place to pee. A mouse that came in here probably wouldn't even notice it, because a metal wouldn't have the kind of mice appreciate. So you're imposing chair. I'm imposing chairness on this object. So every time we do that, we should know that that's what we're doing. The thing is not inherently that whatever we're doing. And this is maybe clear with chairs, but of course it gets a little murky with good and bad. We get a little more invested in that. That's when it's really important we realize that we're imposing that reality on something. This is the meaning of emptiness, by the way. So when you practice Dhanaparamita, or increasing your sense of bounty, get into the flow of reality. You know that any separating out you do is just temporary for a particular reason, for your convenience at the moment. So when you practice Dhanaparamita, there's no giver, receiver, or gift. It's not necessary to separate that out. It's just living. Just being part of the fundamental richness of direct experience. So the richness of just being alive flows into you, and whatever you do flows out of you. So money, food, a place to live, the kindness of strangers, and having a job and all that flows into you. And what flows out of you is money and food and your work, the Dharma, the kindness that you do to others. It just is a flow, an unbroken flow, in and out. So that's Dhanaparamita. That's the practice of that. So what does this take? This giving and receiving is basically the same practice in this. It's just a flow. So when direct experience is your standard for what is true, the first thing you realize is our man-made conceptual world is massively delusional. You know, we just say, this is a chair, this is a cushion. She's a particular person. He's a particular person. This person doesn't understand Dharma. This person is very nice. This person dresses well. If there's nothing wrong with that, just know what it is. Just know what it is. It is not describing any reality but your own. So the conceptual descriptions that we use all the time don't actually touch the real thing, direct experience. And this is what poets try to do. Poets try to evoke with words what can't be described. This is what we say is a good poet. Oh, I understand this person's words, some feeling comes up. It's an art. Those of you who write know that. What an art it is to try to evoke with words what can't be described with words. So understanding that we create this delusory world, our thoughts and judgments and everything, is actually our enlightenment. That's what enlightenment is. So one way to look at enlightenment is that we've learned to take responsibility and recognize our own delusions, our own point of view. So our practice is not to eliminate delusions. I mean, we'd better know what a car is when we're standing on the curb. So it's not to eliminate that stuff at all. It's just to know what it is, to become aware of them so we aren't under their knee-jerk control. So this is what non-preference actually looks like. It's not having preferences. It's just not being jerked around by them, being able to do whatever the occasion calls for. So we get it when we understand just how basic and constant is our tendency to break the one into separate objects. And to understand when you bring the sword of, here we are, the sword of discrimination, when we bring this down, and this is right, and this is wrong, this is good, this is bad, when we do that, we can do it anywhere, anywhere. So this is what makes a flexible person. Understand that. In this situation, you bring the sword down here. In this situation, you bring it down over here. In this situation. So that makes a pretty flexible person. They don't just have this opinion that they carry from place to place. And the sword is always the same, always here. So, although Dhanaparamita sounds like a pretty advanced practice, we actually can enter it anywhere. We can enter it immediately as a beginner. For instance, we can give the gift of our full attention anytime. And I think that I've mentioned this phone practice to the group before, but it's a practice I very much enjoy and recommend to people, which is, if you're going to answer the phone, that's the first decision you have to make, is whether you're going to answer the phone this morning or not. We have the power over these things now. So if you are going to answer the phone, and the phone is on, and there's nothing set to pick it up, then whatever you're doing when the phone rings, you put it down immediately, you orient toward the phone, and by the time you pick up the phone and answer it, you are totally available to that person. Totally available. Well, this can be done as a practice. For years, I didn't answer my phone, and then recently, I decided to do that. This was another instance of letting people in to when I'm driving. Oh, I never answered the phone. That's not very available. So I'll try answering the phone. Well, it turned out I love it. I love answering the phone. So whenever I'm not actively involved with another person, I write quite a bit. The phone rings and I'm in the midst of my writing. Leave my writing, totally orient. Hello. This is very different from you're concentrated on this and grabbing hello, you know. And so this is a practice, giving someone your full attention. And also when you cook a meal, whether it's for yourself or someone else, the same attitude when you, I have an altar in my kitchen and I actually mark off the time by bowing. And then I'm totally available to the food and the cooking process so that you're supporting the people you're cooking for. And if it's yourself, it's really important because this is a bounteous feeling, giving. You're included in all this dana, by the way. So marking off a time that you're totally giving the food your full attention. So I want to describe to you the development of my generosity practice a little bit from the time I came to Zen Center as a young person in my late 20s. I came to Zen Center and I thought I was a generous person. You know, I always gave to people on the street and there weren't that many in those days. But, and a friend wanted something, sure, you know. So I always thought of myself as generous. But living in the building at Zen Center, I mean, they can pick you dry. Pick your bones. So whenever I was in public space, can you do this, can you do that? So I took to hiding out in my room And if somebody would knock on the door, ask me to do something, I pretend like I wasn't there. So this went on for a while, and then I started being troubled by this. So I went to my teacher, the Tanto at the time, the head of practice, who was Reb Anderson at the time, and I said, you know, I have this big gap between, you know, blah, blah, what I've told you. I said, do you mind if I start a selfishness practice? And he said, oh, no, I'll totally support you. I said, well, what I mean is, do you mind if whenever anybody asks me something, I say no? I'll do my house jobs. I'll do all the jobs I'm committed to by living in this building. But whenever anybody asks me to do something else, I say no. He said, fine, I support you. This is just basically political. You know, you have to, if you're going to have go against the stream, you have to have support from the higher-ups. I'm telling you this in case you want to embark on a practice. You can't just strike out on your own. So I started practicing, and at first it was very difficult because I've been so conditioned. When a person comes and says, a person is sick, we need help in the kitchen, could you help? Saying, no, I'm very sorry, I can't. The person is very surprised. And mostly they don't say anything. They just go off with a bad opinion of you. So that was very hard at first, but I got into it. After a while, I started, when tea was served, I started taking the biggest cookie. And then when dessert was served on Friday nights, I took just how much I wanted. I didn't even notice how much was left. So I got into it. Now, I didn't have any particular end point for this practice. I didn't think there will be an end to this. All I knew is that I didn't feel full up. I embarked on this practice because I just felt like I was being picked clean all the time, just bothered and invaded by other people's requests. So this went on for some months. And then the big test came, the very biggest test possible, which was that Baker Roshi, the only teacher at Zen Center, sent his assistant to ask me on a Sunday, my only day off, if I would, they were doing a grant proposal and could I come help type. This is before computers. So a person who actually had to know how to type so that you wouldn't make a lot of errors had to do these things. And I was such a person. So the assistant came and said, we're doing this, can you come over and help? And oh my God, I was on the line. Can I pass this test? So I said, oh, I'm sorry, I can't. You can't? We're getting a grant proposal in. It's due by tonight. You know, we have to get it in at 8 o'clock tomorrow morning. We have to stay up all night. You won't help? No, I'm very sorry. All right then. So Baker Roshi called me in. And I told him about this practice. And he said that he did support my practice, but that the next time he asked me to do something, I should violate this practice. So you learn quite a bit by practicing. So anyway, I continued to do this practice. And one day, when I was in public space, somebody asked me to do something. And I said, sure. And I went and did it. And I realized it finally happened. I got filled up. I got filled up, and now it's spilling over. And I had no idea that this would happen. I mean, I had the best possible result, because I finally got full enough to spill over. And it was a very different feeling than I'd ever had, you know, when I was helping friends or giving to people on the street. It was just completely different. It was like, what else could I do? I just want to spill over onto people, want to do whatever they want me to do. So that was a very happy thing. Now, the point of this, the reason I'm taking all this time and telling you this, is because my motivation was to take care of myself. That was the original motivation for the practice. But I was doing it in a sangha, which was supporting my practice. So, years went by, to make this quick, and I started being a teacher, and I didn't notice at first that I was being a teacher because I had a bodywork practice and gave stress reduction courses in hospitals. That was my profession. I taught meditation, but I didn't think of myself as a Zen teacher. I mean, it's probably never good to think of yourself as a Zen teacher, but nobody else did either. But then people started to, and they started asking me to do things, and it's interesting to me. So I kept doing more, and then that meant less time for clients, paying clients. So I was doing more volunteering, teaching thing than paying clients, and I started worrying about money. And I thought, well, should I just tell people I can't teach and keep the bodywork clients? I had trained apprentices, so I was farming more and more people out to my apprentices. So I thought, no, just go forward, just go forward. Don't be afraid to not have money. Just go. So I went, but I worried all the time. You know, counted the money from the donation box. Oh, my God, oh, my God. And then, a year or two went by with that attitude, worried about money all the time. And, you know, I would get all these solicitations in the mail from groups that I liked and everything, but I never would give them anything. And if people asked me to contribute to a birthday present or anything like that, I would never give money. So I was okay on the time thing, but I noticed, again, it took me a while, oh, I'm not generous with money anymore. I once had the feeling of bounty with money, and I don't anymore. And I'm not generous. So I thought, well, let's just see what happens if you just try a practice of being generous. Let's see how this changes how you feel. So whenever any solicitation came in from anybody that I supported, I would mail back a small amount. You know, and this happened a lot. In fact, in my generous days, another Zen student and I used to just take each cash $100 bills into $5 bills and go downtown and give them out. You know, I mean, no problem. So it was really uncomfortable for me to feel such lack of generosity. So I tried this generosity practice in a time way, too. I thought, well, what keeps me from being available? What keeps me from being just available to anyone on the street or in the halls of Zen Center as I'm walking along, or people stop me when I'm going someplace and want to talk? What keeps me from doing that? And what I found by allowing myself to be interrupted on the street or anything is that I think I have a life. And I thought, well, what does that life consist of, actually? And I thought, well, it consists of teaching others to be generous. Aha! So I started the practice a couple of years ago of, as long as I can stand it, of just saying, today I'm going to be totally available to anything. Money requests, time requests, just open until I can't stand it. And usually it's about a day that I can stand. Then I seem to, it's almost neurophysiological. I seem to close up. I don't want you to stop me anymore. I don't want people on the street to grab me and tell me their hard luck stories. Because I walk slowly and appear, you know, have a limp, tons of people stop me. It's like I can't get away, you know. I'm sitting duck, so everybody stops me. So to not resist any of it, to just let it go on as long as it goes on. And, you know, you have friends that go on and on the phone, to not interrupt that. Just, you know, I had this thing in place where I'd say, you know, I can't listen anymore, can we talk later? But then I stop that, you know, just on and on and on, until I close up. So that has really challenged my idea that I have a life. It's much more flowing. It's much more flowing. What is your life, anyway? Of course, when I have an appointment, I say, can you walk along with me, because I have to get somewhere. So it's just a work in progress for me, Dana Paramita, a work in progress. And the cornerstone of it is generosity to myself as well, for the bounteous feeling. It's only the bounteous feeling that would enable me to have such a practice. So on the street, as I allow myself to be stopped by whores and homeless people and all the kinds of people that live in the Zen Center neighborhood, a very important part of, if you're going to have any practice like that, is noticing what comes in. Because I certainly notice what goes out when I do that availability practice. You know, people stop me all the time. My energy is taken up with other people's hard luck stories or just wanting to communicate. So you have to, in order to have a feeling of bounty, you have to notice what comes in as well. A stranger letting you get on the bus first, or in the case of our neighborhood, one of the chief whores in our neighborhood, who is very solicitous because my husband helped her get off the streets. Whenever she sees me, she gives me something, and she gave me a robe one time, a dirty white robe. I gave her flowers one time. She gives me herbs. She gives me flowers, I'm sure, plucked from other people's gardens. But I noticed this giving spirit. And then also the whores in our neighborhood, whenever I would struggle down the street with something there to carry, oh, let me take that. Take the package I'm carrying, whatever. So the whores in our neighborhood have really, really taken care of me. They would never let anybody hurt me. So you have to, and then when I was very depressed last year, or a couple years ago, I can't remember now, there was some event like being evicted or something, but I think there was something more immediate. But anyway, I was very depressed. I just started being very sad. And then I really noticed, it's like I slowed up, but I noticed how much people were just kind of carrying me around energetically. Since I had no energy, the people that I met with in Doksan and the people who practiced with me in my Sangha, of which Keith is a member, the Crystal Spring Sangha in Burlingame, these were people who were just giving me energy by their attention, by paying attention to me in Doksan, where you do one-on-one, just looking at me and presenting their practice. They were feeding me. Now, that's the kind of thing you don't notice until you're really depressed. Usually I have enough energy that I just don't notice that kind of thing. But if you're really depressed, that's something to notice. How if I sagged, the world kind of holds me up under the arms to get me through. But you have to notice this stuff. It's always doing that. Along this noticing thing, that's maybe one of the most important points. You have to notice the ways that you're sustained as well as the ways that you sustain. For instance, I suggested a koan to a student of mine who complained that she... In fact, I think I told the Iron Bell group in the context of a lecture, this practice that she did impressed me very much. So I want to tell you again. This was a woman who was always saying, why can't I find a man to love? Why can't I find a man for me? There's no very attractive woman, very smart, blah, blah. Why couldn't she find a man? So I suggested that she practice with a koan. And so she came up with the koan of, how am I loved? How can I be loved? And one thing great about koans is they change. You start practicing with them, they just keep drilling, right into the center of you. So they change. So right away, in the first couple of weeks, hers changed to, how do I love? How do I love? To start noticing, how does she love? And that was very fruitful for her for a couple of months. And then, finally, she noticed how her co-workers in her office did little things for her. She was the supervisor. And so people were always leaving things on her desk or helping her out. That's part of the job description. When you're a supervisor, the people that you're supervising do things for you. I mean, that's how it's set up. But she just took this for granted. She didn't think of or just whether it was good work or bad work. She didn't think how people offered her their time and their effort when she asked them to do things. And she started noticing that. So her koan changed to, how am I loved already? And that opened the world. That cracked open whatever it was that kept her disconnected. That question cracked her. And I can't tell you what happened because she ran off with a man. I don't know what happened to her. So, Dogen talks about living in the samadhi of self-fulfillment, or the samadhi of the self fulfilling its function, its natural function. We're born, we breathe, and we die. This is our natural function, the self-fulfilling its natural function. And this self has no object, not me and the chair. It's just all of a piece. It's invisible life. This is Dhanaparamita. You can't consciously, by the way, cultivate this line, this mind, with any particular effort that you make. Isn't that a kill? You can't cultivate it with any particular, I'm going to be generous. You have to approach it indirectly. You have to inform your unconscious. You have to inform your unconscious because this whole process is unconscious. You just start it in motion when you start a sitting practice. And eventually, the only way you can tell it's going on is you begin to notice that you're directed by this mind. You just notice here and there. For instance, when I was a body worker, a person in my sangha asked me to work on her, and I didn't like this person. So I thought, oh, I don't want to touch her. I really don't like her. And I went to Reb, the Tanto, again, and said, blah, blah, and he said, do it anyway. So she came in to lay down on the massage table. I put my hands on her, and it all went away, all my dislike. My body flowed into her body flowed into my body. So my opinion of things didn't make any difference. I'd have to say that was the first time I ever noticed some process going on. And then recently I moved from San Francisco up to Sonoma County, and an old Zen student I had sat with for a long time at Gulch said, you know, I really don't like the competition up here. This is pain management competition, not Zen teacher competition. He said, you know, there's not that many people. It's not that, you know, like San Francisco. It's not a big place where there's lots of clients, so I just don't think put your flyers for your pain group up in my town. Well, I said, gee, I can't believe this. I said, in San Francisco, there's no end to suffering. There's nothing limitless. You can't work hard enough or long enough to help suffering people. He said, well, it's different here. There's only a population of so many, blah, blah. So we went round and round. I insisted on putting my flyers up. And he wanted to have meetings with me so he could change my mind. And I thought to myself, this guy is a total asshole. You know, I mean, I'm not dealing with this. This is just beneath me. I moved to a place and I'm going to do my work and nobody's going to stop me. And then he called up, you know, to make a meeting date. And instead of telling him off like I had decided to do, I found myself saying just the opposite. I couldn't believe it. I said, I will never abandon you. Because we sat at Green Gulch together all those years. I said, as long as you have a problem with me, I will meet with you, and I will never stop meeting with you. I am committed to you. I couldn't believe I'm saying this, but it seemed to come from some deeper place. And when he heard that, he said, oh, there was a big silence on the other end of the phone. And our next meeting, we planned the meeting of that phone call. The next meeting that we met to talk about this problem, he just gave me a list of all the pain clinics in the area and said, I know the directors of all of them. You just call them up and mention my name. So it came out of him, too. He met whatever came out of me with his own. with his own. So this is what happens when you practice. And you don't have to notice this kind of stuff, but it sure is great because it's very encouraging if you do. Now, of course, you notice all the times you fail to be generous and kind, too. That's helpful as well. But I'm telling you the good stuff. So, we should stop. So please today commit yourself and offer yourself to whatever your experience is. Thank you very much.